Hello, my name is Marie Bilodeau, and you are listening to On the Edge. We're now very pleased to welcome Hugo and Nebula award-winning author Robert J. Sawyer. Welcome.
Hi, Marie.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Having a great time.
Good. You've been running around a lot at the con?
It's been a very busy convention, very well run, lots of exciting things to see and do. And last night, I was hosting the hospitality suite because I know we're here for Edge Press, but I also edit the science fiction line for another Canadian publisher. I do the Robert J. Sawyer books imprint for FitzHenry and Whiteside. FitzHenry and Whiteside is the distributor for Edge Press, so we're very collegial. And last night I was hosting a big party here.
That's nice, and you look so awake today. So
I got it. Well, you know, we got an extra hour's sleep last night because the clocks fell back last night, so
that's true.
I'm doing okay.
That's very lucky. So you've actually done work on the Tesseract before Tesseract.
My wife Carolyn Klink and I edited the sixth volume in the Tesseract series called, very cleverly, Tesseract 6. I think it came out in 1997. We're very proud of it. We published Nello Hopkinson's first story. We had, I think, four of the five Aurora nominees for short fiction that year were from our anthology. Our anthology was nominated for an Aurora, and it was the first volume in the history of the Tesseract series to sell out its print run. So we were very, very pleased with that book, and just very proud of the writers that we were able to publish.
I can imagine. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the editing process? Like, what did you find? How did you go about it?
Yeah, Tesseract has been unusual since the very first one, which was done with Judith Merrill as the editor. Ever since, there have been multiple editors, two editors on each volume. And that means, it's interesting, because it means there has to be a dialogue between the editors about what they like and what they don't like. It turned out that Carolyn and I had never edited anything before, really had never even worked together before. We weren't sure how it was going to go. It was actually an experiment. And it turned out that we actually had pretty congruent tastes. It also is true that although the Tesseract anthologies get a lot of submissions, like anything in publishing, most of them aren't very good. That's the sad truth. So it wasn't like, you know, there were hundreds of choices. We actually did not do a particularly fat volume of Tesseract. Tesseract 4, that was prior to ours. Tesseract 8, I guess, were bigger books than ours were. We published every first-rate story that we got. Period. It really, at the end of the day, we published every one of them that was an excellent story, and then we stopped. We could have put in a few more stories, and we thought, no, you know, we were just so totally thrilled about each of these stories that there was no reason to go for a fatter book at that point. Now, that was before Brian came on as publisher. Candace Jane Dorsey was publisher at that time, and she supported us in that choice. We said, we're done. It's a shorter book than some of the predecessors, but it's first-rate stuff. And the reviews bore that out. The award nominations bore that out. There's not a bad piece in the book.
That's wonderful. Good to hear. Now, what would you say, as the editor of that anthology, were some of the biggest mistakes that you saw that made you reject the stories?
Well, we try to be very generous about being forgiving in a way that, say, the American science fiction magazines Analog and Asimov's wouldn't be. So we forgave bad manuscript format. We forgave, you know, things that normally would have just been rejected as not being in proper format. But it was astonishing, Marie, how much of that we saw, even from writers who should have known better, who didn't know how to do a manuscript format. And I'll just say, I have a website, sfwriter.com, that has a how-to write section. In the how-to write section, click on manuscript format, and you'll learn how to do it. It's not hard. It's industry standard. It applies everywhere in English language publishing, and I was astonished how many people couldn't do that. What surprised me, given my involvement with the anthology, was how few hard science fiction stories were submitted. Authors who actually said, oh, you know, I kept getting, meaning to get something done, Carl Schrader is an example, and didn't. And he would have been a shoo-in. Anybody who gave us a good hard SF story would have been a shoo-in. We were very surprised at how little of what played to my strengths was submitted, and instead how much fantasy was submitted. But they were good fantasies, so we bought them. Subsequently, Tesseract has done a lot of almost theme-oriented volumes in the anthology. For instance, Nancy Kilpatrick and David Morrell, who are well known for their horror work, are editing the current volume of Tesseract. That does send a signal to the community of the sort of thing receptive to. What will surprise me, but I bet Nancy or David is going to say to me, is, you know what we got is tons of hard SF and nobody sent us any decent horror. So pay attention to who the editors are. That was the biggest mistake, is not really giving a lot of thought to what the market was.
That's it.
Now, we were the first Tesseract. Our six came 1 month, 1 year after five.
Okay.
It had been 2 or 3 years prior to that, and then they got ambitious and they were going to be once a year. So we know that in our year, and now they're back to once a year, says Brian Hades. We know that in our year, people were going to their trunks, their drawers, to find stories, because in a year, they didn't have time to write a lot of new stories. So some of the stories we saw, there was no doubt that they'd been seen by the people who had edited the volume before us, and would be seen by the people who had edited the volume after us. But there were also people who sent in stories. We were doing this in the mid-90s with 1980s copyright dates on the stories. They were telegraphing that this was some piece of trash that had been floating around for years. And don't do that. Obviously, if you're submitting to a small press, everybody knows there are markets that pay better, have bigger circulations and so forth, and might even advance your career more. So we know that we're not necessarily everybody's first choice. But don't advertise that. You should always have the illusion, just like, you know, if you're going out at a bar and you're trying to pick up a woman or a man, you don't go up and say, well, I've been turned down 4 times, so will you give me a shot, right? You say, how you doing, baby? And you let that, and if you've said it 8 times that night, it's still supposed to be the first time, as far as the other woman's concerned, that, you know.
You heard it straight from Robert Jensen. Sorry there, people.
That's right. How you doing? That's supposed to be fresh, not, I'm sorry, I tried everywhere else, and you're the only one left in the bar. It's almost closing time. You want to go home? That doesn't work. It doesn't work in publishing. It doesn't work in bars.
That's fair. Now, you're in an interesting position right now where you are a very prolific author, and you're a Canadian author being published through in the States, and you have very good distribution. But you're also an avid reader. Where do you see Canadian science fiction going now from where it was when you began writing?
You know, it's funny because people have wrestled with this for really since Judy Merrill kind of stood up on the page with Tesseract 1 and said there is a critical mass of Canadian SF. Okay, good. Yeah. But what is the distinguishing characteristic other than we all happen to live in Canada?
Yeah.
Canada is a huge, diverse country. We celebrate multiculturalism. Is there anything we all have in common? And the answer is there's nothing that we all have in common. When Judy was doing this in the early 80s, there were people like me who were writing hard SF. There were people like Steve Sterling who write alternate history. There were people who were writing literary science fiction like Terrence M. Green. There didn't seem to be a common denominator. And I'm not sure there is one yet today, but I will say that I think there's a good niche for an academic to look at science fiction that comes out of Canada that deals with the nature of consciousness. Scott Baker, R. Scott Baker, that's B-A-K-K-E-R, pronounced Baker, Peter Watts, and myself, among others, have been doing a lot of really interesting writing about why it is like something to be self-aware, why there is an internal life, what it means, what the evolutionary advantage of actually having an inner mental landscape is. And we certainly talk periodically. Peter and I have argued on panels, and Scott has been over at my house, and we've had kind of just a chinwag over theories of consciousness. It's not a movement, but it is very interesting that we Canadians are gravitating to this issue. Now, you could argue one reason is we always had this issue of what is the national identity in Canada. We deal with issues of consciousness in Canada in that sense. The other is that consciousness studies is not, it is a legitimate science, which it wasn't 20 or 30 years ago. There's a wonderful peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Consciousness Studies, now. And, you know, when I did a minor in psychology, late 70s, early 80s, the word consciousness was never mentioned in psychology class. It meant nothing. There was no scientific basis for it. It was a black box. We didn't have MRI scans. You couldn't look at what was happening in the brain. And it was just an amorphous, airy-fairy term, so you wouldn't use it in a scientific context. Now it is a solid science, and we're making progress in it in areas like AI, which fascinates me, in areas like philosophy, which is what Scott Baker is pursuing a PhD in, and in areas of neuroscience and so forth. Peter Watts is a marine biologist, but with a great interest in neurobiology. So we come at it from these areas, and I think it's actually one of the reasons we're attracted to it in Canada is it's not rocket science, by which I mean it's not big butts science. Canada, which does not have gigantic research labs and huge budgets, can make real progress in this area, which an awful lot of which is just deep thinking about complex issues. If there's a Canadian identity that will emerge in the next decade, I think you will see people talking about the movement, the consciousness, the science of consciousness movement in Canadian SF will be what the academics will look back and identify the first decade of the 21st century of Canadian science fiction as having concentrated on.
Very interesting. Now, you have a new novel coming out. I believe there's some test readers copy.
Apropos of this, yes, my new novel is called Wake, W-A-K-E. It's the first novel in a trilogy about the World Wide Web gaining consciousness. Wake, Watch, and Wonder are the three volumes, and it is indeed my rumination about an awful lot of how consciousness came into being for us. We know that it did. We didn't used to be conscious in our ancestors than we are now. There certainly was something that happened that caused that to happen. Penguin Canada, for the first time ever, I'm having a domestic Canadian publisher for my novel. I've done work with Edge before as an editor, and I've done anthologies that have been published in Canada. My short story collections are published by FitzHenry and Whiteside in Canada. I've never had a novel with a Canadian publisher. I do now. I split the rights between Canada and the United States for the first time. So Penguin Canada very kindly donated 300 bound galleys of Wake to this conference, the World Fantasy Convention here in Calgary, Alberta. And there are about 750 people here, so, you know, a little less than half of the people got given a free copy of this upcoming book. Why? To generate some buzz, to get people talking about it, and so that when the book actually comes out on April 7th, 2009, there will be some buzz. There will be some people who can do word of mouth. I read that. It's pretty good. You should buy it. Instead of that having to take weeks or months after the book comes out, there will actually be, from the get-go, people who are familiar with the text.
Smart. Good marketing strategy.
Indeed it is.
Now, you do have a website, sfwriter.com, that gives a lot of advice to new and upcoming writers. But if you had to give one kernel of truth here to the new authors that are kind of milling about the con, what would that be?
It's actually a two-edged thing. The first is that only you can write your stories. So to write those stories, people who come to me and say, what's hot right now, are wasting their time. Because if I said to you what's hot right now, as I just alluded to, perhaps consciousness studies is hot right now. Well, it is. But if you start writing your book today and take a year to write it, and if you're within a year or two of having finished it, and if the publisher fast-tracks it and gets it out within just a year, then what I tell you is hot, and as we're doing this conversation at the beginning of November in 2008 at the World Fantasy Convention in Calgary, is that going to be hot at the end of 2011? It's a meaningless question. You should write the story that you are burning inside to write. That said, last weekend, or maybe the weekend before, I was at the Surrey International Writers Conference in British Columbia. And that's a conference for people who want to write. And somebody came up to me who had already self-published a science fiction book and asked me, who are the science fiction publishers? And I thought, how could you possibly not have done any market research? How could you possibly not have a bookstore? If your goal is to have books in a bookstore, aren't you a habitué of bookstores? Don't you haunt them? Aren't you there all the time, picking up every book on the shelf in the science fiction section, starting with the A's and working your way down to the Z's or the Z's, and looking and saying, okay, here's a hard SF novel by, let's say, Alan Steele, and his publisher is Ace, and it says his editor is Ginger Buchanan. So obviously they do hard science fiction and they do it well. It's an interstellar adventure novel, and Ginger obviously must be interested in that sort of thing. You learn this by going to a bookstore. So on the one hand, I say, don't ask me what the trends are, but the other is, don't ask me what the markets are. You should find out the markets, write the story you want to write, and then know the market so well that it's obvious to you which publisher you should submit to, including quite conceivably, of course, Edge here in Calgary.
Yeah, do your research. That's a very good advice.
Totally.
Very nice. And you certainly do a lot of research with every one of your novels.
I do. I love the research. If I could just do the research and not have to write the darn books, I'd be a content man. But nobody's willing to pay me the big bucks to just do research. So.
You can't win them all.
You can't win them all.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you.
Take
Cheers.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.